about five would be more than adequate, sir. The first thing you all, after we filed this, you all had the clerk call us and ask us to be prepared to address the issue of jurisdiction of this court. So I went into that, as did Ms. Wooten, and I think the court has jurisdiction over some, but not all of the issues. The issue of whether or not the court was correct, the lower court was correct in granting the divorce, appears to me to be governed by the...
Well, let me interrupt you, sure. Mr. Ryan, because it seems to me you've got four hurdles to get over here. The first is jurisdiction, and really the case that I think you need to deal with is DeHaan versus DeHaan, and whether or not because the equitable distribution and the spousal support and the attorney's fees issues remain undecided in the circuit court, whether we have whether this is a final order or an interlocutory order over which we have jurisdiction. That's the first hurdle. Second hurdle is, given that that the pleadings in this case are inconsistent, the pleading in the case alleges basically what amounts to no possibility of reconciliation, and now that legal position by your client has changed on appeal, whether that's approbating and reprobating, that such as to waive the issue. Thirdly, whether or not the failure to object on the to the order entered, what effect that has, and then finally, if we get to the merits, the fact that the guardian ad litem testified in this case that the husband, in the, prior to his death, indicated a desire that there would be no reconciliation. So, given those are the four hurdles, it seems to me you have to deal with, but we can't get past any of them until we deal with that first one regarding our jurisdiction.
Well, I think you're right. I think as far as whether or not the divorce was properly granted, this court does have jurisdiction. And I would cite an old case of Cumming versus Cumming, which is a 1920 case in 102 Southeast at page 572. In the Cumming case, the situation was that a woman got pregnant prior to the marriage, and somewhere along the line, the husband and wife decided to get married for the sole purpose of giving the child a name and also to not to have the wife shamed. The court went on a little bit about her reputation in the past, and they entered into a pre-nuptial or anti-nuptial agreement in that case. And after the case was tried in the circuit court, the husband prevailed and the wife appealed. The court of, well, in that case, we didn't have a court of appeals back then. The Supreme Court found that the agreement that they did was simply to facilitate a divorce and said it that it was inappropriate under the public policy of Virginia. After the case was appealed, the husband died, and the Virginia Supreme Court ruled on that, and they essentially said that no decree will be entered on those subjects referring to child support and custody or alimony, which would be inoperative. But they did say that they had the jurisdiction to deal with the divorce decree, which they found was improperly granted on the evidence. That's so I think based on that, there is jurisdiction.
Well, our DeHaan case says as follows. In the light of the strong policy considerations against frequent interlocutory appeal, we conclude that where a trial court in a divorce suit enters an order resolving only some of the main objects of the suit, such an order does not normally adjudicate the principles of a cause. To hold otherwise would permit divorce litigants to appeal each order of the trial court adjudicating the divorce, custody, equitable distribution, etc. The court goes on to say these problems would particularly manifest themselves in cases such as this one arising for Fairfax County, where the trial court apparently bifurcates every divorce case. Every case would generate multiple appeals. The disruption of the trial process and expense to the parties would prove severe. And the court goes on to say that because not all of the chief objects of the suit, and in Dahan it included equitable distribution and spousal support, had been resolved, we lacked jurisdiction to consider the one matter that had been resolved in the trial court. So, I guess we're bound by that decision unless you can find a way to distinguish it or convince us that it doesn't apply here somehow.
Well, I think it doesn't apply, and there is a case, and it's probably in these piles, but I'm looking for it. I'm sure I won't find it until rebuttal, unfortunately, but there is a case in Virginia kind of addressed that. And in that case, what happened was there was a bifurcation in the trial court, and years later, the wife brought an action for equitable distribution, and the husband...
A separate action, I assume, right?
Correct. And his husband brought a separate action, and the trial court said, the Court of Appeals in that said, no, you should have appealed the first order, the order granting the divorce. So based on that, that's what I based it...
Is that the Spriggs case?
Yes, thank you. I've copied too many.
That's all right.
But on the Spriggs case, I think that gives me, and the court here, clear direction that if, and I agree, it may be a real catch-22, but I took that case to read that if I didn't appeal the granting of the final divorce, that I would be out of luck coming in here at a later date.
The law is pretty murky, and that's why we asked the parties to address it. I don't want you to use up all your time on that.
And you have a wonderful opportunity to make some bright-line law here.
Well, I'm not sure it's all that well preserved here since we had to ask you guys
to address it.
But, let me ask you this about how do you want to address the waiver issue given the inconsistency in the pleadings below and on appeal?
Well, that troubled me. I did not file this case.
I understand that.
And the first thing that I said out loud, I confess, when I heard that was happening, I said, oh, gee, I wish you'd have filed a separate maintenance case instead of filing for a divorce. There's a lot of cases in Virginia about judicial estoppel, and that does trouble me. But I don't think filing, just a simply filing of a case, locks somebody into their position.
Well, the problem is in a civil suit, you file the pleadings that have certain allegations in them, which are either admitted or denied.
That's
and
correct.
And they're under oath. And if they're admitted, then of course there's no proof required because there's the judicial economy and all that. Everybody's agreeing, and that's what happened here. I realize you weren't the attorney at the time, but your client filed a pleading in the circuit court asserting that there was no possibility of reconciliation, and that was admitted in the responsive pleading by the husband in this case. Therefore, there was no necessity to litigate that. And now it comes up on appeal, and the issue is whether reconciliation
There is a need to litigate because it still all ties into whether or not there is an intent to terminate the marital relationship, and that's essential. I don't care what you plead, but you still have to prove it. And you still would have to prove the intent to terminate the marital relationships, which in my position, our position is that has not been proven.
All right. What about the failure to object, procedural default?
Well, I filed a motion in advance of the bifurcation setting forth some reasons that I didn't think that it should be bifurcated. And then when we were having the hearing on the divorce, I reiterated to the court on the record that I still have all my objections relative to bifurcation. When we were in court, there was substantial talk, a fair amount of talk anyway, about whether or not intent was an integral part of this case. And reliance on 8.01-394, I feel that I've made my objections. And the legislature has been pretty clear there that you only have to object once. And if it's clear as to what the objections are and what the issue in the court is, then the wording just seen and objected to is sufficient for the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, as it may be, to take jurisdiction of a case.
All right. Well, and of course, if we got to the merits, the allegation is that the there's no evidence in the record I'm not sure how to phrase it. There's an allegation, I guess, from your client, or some testimony from your client that indicated that there was a possibility of reconciliation, and the guardian ad litem testified without objection that his interview with, or the guardian's interview with the husband indicated that the husband was adamant about not reconciling. So where does that leave us?
Well, there was no testimony at all as to whether or not there was an intent to terminate the marriage. Just at the end, he says there was no intent. I'm adamant about reconciling. But you have to have that intent to terminate. You have to have grounds for 1 year to get a divorce on the 1 year separation. And the grounds don't start until somebody forms an intent to separate. Mrs. Friedman testified. She didn't have an intent to testify. As you recall from reading the transcript, the judge was picked up on that right away and said, well, that's speaking just from your side, of course. But there was never any evidence from the husband that he intended to separate, at least a year before the actual before the hearing. And I think the record was clear on that. We made that issue during the course of the hearings. We made it during the prior hearing on whether or not there should be bifurcation, and it was well brought up. So I think it has been preserved.
All right, you're into your rebuttal time, so.
Okay. This always goes faster than anybody anticipates. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Evans. Ms. Wooten?
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry to have.
Yes, sir. I think you've given me some direction with what you pointed out to Mr. Evans, so I'll start with the fact of whether this court has jurisdiction. And as Your Honor said, the law is murky, but I think the law is only murky on the issue of whether an interlocutory appeal is, whether this is an interlocutory appeal or whether that's then appealable. But I don't actually think we get there. I think that this is actually a final order. And I think that this is a final order, and therefore 17.1-4053B applies, and so it's appealable because it is a final order in the nature of divorce. And I think that we get there because not only has the legislature said so when you look at 20-107.3, but this court has said so in cases like Weizenbaum, and public policy also says that this order should be deemed final. I'll start first of all with the legislature, and when you look at 20-107.3, which is our bifurcation statute, and the current evolution of that statute, I believe going back to 1991, says that the court on the motion of either party may retain jurisdiction in the final decree of divorce to adjudicate the remedy provided by this section, the equitable distribution, when the court determines that such action is clearly necessary, and then it continues. What's important to note there is they use the term final. They don't just say in the decree of divorce. They use the term final. And while I understand that if we as litigators and or even the circuit courts label an order final, it doesn't mean that it's final just because of the label. I think the legislature has spoken quite clearly that they intend that when their bifurcation statute is invoked, that the decree of divorce is to be determined as one that is final, and therefore then is applicable to 17.1-4053B. If we look at, and I'll jump to the public policy issues, there's a lot of public policy.
Let me just stop you right there. Mm-hmm. So if I understand your argument correctly, essentially your position is that because of the language used by the legislature, when a circuit court grants a bifurcation motion, essentially one case becomes two cases.
And, yes.
And Okay, and then, and we deal with them then separately from that point forward?
Yes, sir. And I think that that's what's anticipated here, not only when they use that term, but if you look at all of the historical analysis and the evolution of that statute itself, there's a lot of discussion about finality and the need for finality. Also, if you look at public policy reasons, and again, if you're looking at the interlocutory appeals and whether those are appealable, a lot of the basis, especially in DeHaan, which I understand you were on that panel, there's a lot of discussion about public policy reasons. Well, there's a lot of public policy reasons for why a final decree, whether it's, we use that term so often, we call them final decrees. And I think that that's because the public and the citizens believe that when there is a decree granting them a divorce and separating their bonds of matrimony, that that's it and that's final. And we have to look at public policy issues. What if my client...
Well, how do we deal with DeHaan? I mean, DeHaan, I guess, I'm not sure, DeHaan uses the term bifurcation. I'm not sure.
It's not.
I mean, apparently the practice in Fairfax, if I remember the DeHaan cases, they bifurcate everything, and so you,
yes,
you wind up with multiple appeals, and that kind of defeats, as DeHaan, the language DeHaan points out, that kind of defeats the whole purpose of judicial economy when you go about it that way. So, but I mean,
it's a bifurcation or a reservation. I mean, those are two technically different issues. The bifurcation has a statutory scheme that grants, and I believe the Court of Appeals used this term, a special jurisdiction. So with that understanding, first of all, I think DeHaan is obviously differentiated factually. It's not really a bifurcation case. A decree of divorce was not entered. In that case,
it was,
for lack of a better term, a pendente lite thing. I mean, they believed that the issues addressed were finally dealt with, but it was that Judge Pro Temp and his order. Again, he wasn't tasked with decreeing the divorce, and there was no decree of divorce, no bifurcation language. And so the court in that case, I believe, rightly said, you know, this matter is not final. It doesn't get to the crux of the case. And when you're filing a divorce, the crux of the case, the principal, again, that's only on interlocutory issues. And in that case, though the court goes into a lot of public policy reasons, I think there are equally strong, I actually think there are stronger public policy reasons. If you even have to get to public policy, again, I think the legislature is clear that this is meant to be final. But the public policy reasons, what if my client, after the parties were divorced and prior to him dying, got remarried? And then the equitable distribution matters years down the road are finally concluded, and then they go back and attack later because that decree is not deemed final, that final decree divorce. I think there are public policy reasons why we shouldn't have those issues, I mean, those problems. What if after the divorce was granted, the parties, one of them went out and bought a $1 million piece of property and then passed without leaving a will? And then years later, after ED is done, the divorce is then attacked at that point because it's not allowed to be attacked now and considered final. And then what you have is you have an issue where now that $1 million piece of property may pass intestate, may pass to a former spouse. I mean, there are a lot of public policy reasons, and that's a lot of what the court has based the whole interlocutory appeal issue on. There are a lot of public policy reasons why to deem this final. But again, I don't even know if we get there because I think the legislature has made that clear. This is a unique situation. They spent a lot of time between, I believe, 1986 and 1991 getting us where we are on the bifurcation issue.
Okay. You want to address the other issues?
Sure, Judge. On the issue of possibility of reconciliation, again, I respectfully don't believe that his client actually testified, Mr. Evans' client actually testified that there was a possibility of reconciliation. I believe Mr. Evans made some comments. I don't believe there was actual evidence or testimony about that. And
well, I'm looking at page 387 of the joint appendix, and Mrs. Friedman is on the witness stand, I believe, and the court actually asked her a question. When you separated, did at least one of you intend to end the marriage? And she, her answer is no. The court, I assume you're speaking for yourself. Her answer, I think he just wanted me to do something, change something, and I was advised not to change it. It was one Beach Corolla. And then I think, but I believe that's what Mr. Evans relies upon for his preservation argument.
Well, I think that respectfully, those are two different issues. Whether there's an opportunity for reconciliation is a different issue of whether there was intent for separation. And again, I don't think he, just like we said in our brief, he didn't preserve that for appeal. And I can get into all the case law. Of course, you're extremely familiar with the case law that says that you have to object, you have to do so with specificity, you have to do so to put us and the trier of fact on notice so that anything can possibly be cured at the lower level rather than going through the effort of being here. And again, I think that what he's saying here today and what he pled in his brief is much different than what is on the record. And there's a lot of discussion about that in our brief in and of itself. But I think the reconciliation issue is a different issue than our possibility thereof, which there wasn't testimony on, is different than the intent issue. And if the court found that he had for some reason, objected correctly to give us sufficient notice. Again, it's up to the trier of fact to decide whether they believe the witness or not. And it's in his brief, I understand that he wrote that she said no to that answer, but we need to go further because then she had a follow-up spontaneously almost, and it would be up to the trier of fact to determine what her body language was at the time, how she was answering that question. You also have to remember that the trier of fact in this case had heard a whole lot of other testimony, and I believe we had 17 hearings in this case in that year time frame, and knows these parties. And so that's one reason why we don't mess with that, why we leave that to the trier of fact to decide whether she was lying at that issue because it best suited her case at the moment. But when you look at her complaint, she was pleading for a divorce a year earlier and said that she had the intent to separate at that time. And so that's why we leave it to the trier of fact. But more importantly, again, I don't think we get there because I don't think he properly objected at the time.
Okay.
On the other, and I guess that gets to your third issue about the failure to object. And Your Honor, I'd ask for a little direction on the next issue when you talk about the GAL testifying about, I believe you said.
Well, I guess the issue is whether there was any possibility of reconciliation. The trial court clearly found there was not. The question
yes.
is there evidence in the record to support that? It seems to me that comes from the GAL's testimony, which was unobjected to.
It was unobjected to, and therefore, again, not properly before the court, but I think in Andrews versus Creasy, I believe it is, when it talks about that a divorce can be granted solely upon the guardian ad litem's determination that it's in the best interest of his ward, with the understanding when you have a guardian ad litem, your witness isn't often indisposed at the moment and therefore not there. And
well, I think in this context, the guardian ad litem is, I mean, it's clearly hearsay and is essentially relaying the wishes of the principal here.
Yes.
So it's not the guardian ad litem's independent assessment. It's, I mean, they're acting as essentially a messenger and it would clearly be hearsay, but it was unobjected to, so it's before the court, and there's no issue, no legal issue that was raised at the time regarding its admissibility. So, I mean that's the hurdle, I think, that I indicated Mr. Evans needed to address and that you need to address.
Correct. There was no objection, therefore it's not before the court. It could have been dealt with at that time. But again, here we get into the complexities of guardian ad litem. I believe last time I was before Judge Kelsey on this issue, we had a long discussion about our guardian ad litem system and hearsay, and the hearsay issues that have come up with the guardian ad litem scheme and how it's set up at this point. But again, the court has even deemed in Andrews versus Creasy that guardian ad litem on behalf of their ward can come in and present the information. And I believe actually in this case, I believe it went past just relaying his wishes, but actually went to an assessment that he deemed it in his ward's best interest to grant this divorce. And I believe that just on that alone, the court says that just on that alone, solely upon the guardian ad litem's interpretation and determination, that intent can be established and that the divorce can be entered.
Okay.
So, Judge, with that being said, I think, again, their first assignment, I believe, is not properly before the court. The second one on bifurcation, we stand on our brief that it's clearly necessary. The court, being the trier of fact and having a lot of discretion there, had quite enough information to proceed with the bifurcation.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Evans.
Thank you. All right. I didn't object to the guardian ad litem's testimony because there was no evidence from the guardian ad litem about that necessity of intent. Now, counsel pointed out in her brief that we did not object to the appointment of a guardian ad litem. I'll also point out to you that I filed a motion asking this court, excuse me, the trial court, to declare Mr. Friedman incompetent. The court didn't do that. So what you're faced with is how to reconcile 20-91-9A that talks about the use of a guardian ad litem. And it says if either party has been judged insane, then you can get, and you have a guardian ad litem or a committee, then there can be a divorce without intent. Because obviously if somebody is not competent, they're not competent to make the decision on intent.
But do we even need to go there if there is evidence of intent?
Yeah, I think you do. I think evidence of intent is clearly required.
No, but if there is, but if it exists,
but then there isn't any evidence of intent.
The guardian ad litem testified without objection as to what the husband's intent was.
But that's irrelevant that he testified as to what the intent was when he interviewed him 2-3 days before the hearing. The question of intent is you have to have that intent throughout the duration of the separation.
There was no objection.
That's correct. There's no objection, but it's still incumbent on the plaintiff, not the plaintiff, the defendant in that case, to prove that case and prove the element of intent. Thank you.
Your contention is that the intent needed to exist at the time of the separation.
Well, at least for one, at least for a period of a year prior to the hearing. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you. All right, as is our tradition, we will come down and greet counsel and then take up the next case.